Medinde, Ojirapo, Kwesi Ra, Nehem Pata, Akan, Ojirapo, Akwamomine, Amaruka, Etipimu. Michiamo means greetings to Apurakanu, Apuraikaitu, meaning African, black people. Today is Eguada, which means marketplace day. And we will be bringing our guest on in a couple of minutes. First, we just want to go over some basic information, some announcements. We have a presentation coming up. We will be speaking in Camp Springs, Maryland, this Akwesi Da, this Sunday, June 22nd, 12 p.m. You can check our website for the details on that. Ojirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in freedom, O.com. That's O-D-W-I-R-A-F-O.com. And you can get all the information regarding that presentation. We also have a presentation coming up on July 5th in Hartford, Connecticut. You can check the website for that information as well. We also have our weekly, we have two shows every week on Benada or Abenada, which is Tuesday. We have our show Ojira, which means purification, where we deal with Nanasom, Afurakani, Afuraikaidin ancestral religion. And we go into detail about different aspects of our culture, cosmology, ritual practice, and how Ojira purification operationalizes Nanasom, operationalizes Afurakani, Afuraikaidin ancestral religion. All of the archives of all of our shows can be found on our Blog Talk Radio page, Ojirafo, the Ojirafo page. Every Akuada or Owukuda Wednesday, we have our Egua Marketplace show where we showcase Afurakani, Afuraikaitini, or African business owners, people who have organizations, work in the community, any kind of enterprise that's beneficial for the Afurakani, Afuraikaitini community, but also the individuals hold our authentic Afurakani, Afuraikaitini ancestral values as well, and they express those values through the businesses and the organizations that they own and that they and the services that they provide for the community. So this is what we do on a weekly basis. We also have our publications. If you look on the Nhoma page of our Ojirafo website, we have about 12 publications, over 60 articles, about 48 videos. We also have audio, all of the PDF versions, the ebook versions of our books, our free downloads, and then we sell the soft cover version. So in the soft cover versions of our books, we have about 7 available. We will post the link in the chat room right now. It's the Nhoma page of the website where you can access the soft cover versions of the books. You can order those. They range between $8 and $11. The ebook versions are all free. We make those free. And then you can also access links to the publications, the articles, as well as the videos. Okay, so anything else? Let's see. We have a couple of people here, and we also have a couple of some people filling up the call queue right now. If you want to interact in the chat room, you must log in. If you don't have an account, you can develop an account very quickly, and then you can interact in the chat. And of course, you can push number 1 if you have a question on the phone. Just push number 1, and that will raise your hand, and then we'll know that you want to make a question, or have a question, or you want to make a comment. So, okay, so let's move forward to our guest. Nice guest is Kamal Makasi Tahuti. Kamal is an author. He's the author of the book How to Make a Negro Christian, where he analyzes the publications of Reverend Charles Colcock Jones, one of the individuals, the Etchiwadifo, Spirits of Disorder, the Whites in the Offspring, who basically pioneered forcing Christianity into the minds and spirits of our people during the end period of the enslavement period and afterwards. So when we talk about the that Christianity was forced on our people here in America during and after enslavement. He goes through a methodical process, reprints the presentations of this white so-called minister, proving in detail the methodical approach that they use to brainwash our people with Christianity and try to stamp out any vestiges of ancestral culture, because they understood that when we embrace our ancestral culture, that is what would happen when we would revolt against the whites in our offspring. Nat Turner and other individuals, when they try to force the idea that all these individuals were Christians, they were following their ancestresses and ancestors, they were emboldened and inspired to massacre the whites in their offspring, burn down plantations, and free their brothers and sisters from the plantation. The reason why slavery was ended was because of the actions of those who were engaged in Afuraikane, Afuraikaiti, ancestral religion, who took up arms, waged war, killed the whites in their offspring, men, women, and children, burned down plantations, and began to free our people. These insurrections, these revolutions, these resistance movements, armed resistance movements, all across the southern, southeastern United States, as well as into the northern colonial holdings of the whites and their offspring, this is what forced them to embrace abolition. They didn't come about abolition because, you know, they just had a good heart and they were moral. They were forced to embrace abolition and move towards abolition because they saw that we were beginning to wake up and we were massacring the people, them. They also saw what happened in Haiti. They saw what was happening in Jamaica. They saw what was happening in South America. In all the various regions where we were, Afuraikane, Afuraikaiti people were raising up. They were becoming victorious. They were expelling the whites and their offspring from the land. They were killing them, and therefore they didn't want that to happen to the United, to the so-called 13 colonies. So they decided to move towards abolition. But in that process, they wanted to brainwash us with a new form of mental enslavement, and that's when they began to force Christianity upon our people. And then, of course, a few decades later, they began to force Islam on our people, Hebrewism on our people, through the agency of Negroes like Noble Drew Ali and other individuals who started pushing these white foolish doctrines. But Kamal goes into how they forced Christianity on our people, so you'll never be confused after you read that book about how they meticulously and methodically ingrain that nonsense into the minds of some of our people who open themselves up for that. And on the website, he just posted the link, lulu.com/Kamal301 for your copy, how to order, how to make a Negro Christian, the softcover version. And also, Kamal is also the publisher of African World Analysis, which is a periodical. He's been publishing that periodical for over 10 years. He has 34 issues. You can order those issues from his website, africanworldanalysis.com. African-centered analysis of various issues, culture, current news events, politics, economics, and so forth. So it's a lot of information, good information, and it's good analysis. Kamal also is the host of Africa's Reascension on Blog Talk Radio on Sunday nights, Akwesi Da, Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. So all those different things that Kamal is doing, we want to bring Kamal in. And so let's get it started. Michiewo, Kamal, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Michiewo. Wow, this is so cool.
Okay, may I say for coming on, for, you know, sharing the time with us tonight. We want to get into these publications. We want people to, you know, be made aware of these publications. We want people to order the publications, you know, support the work that you've been doing for 10 years, 10 plus years. So first, let's get into how did you begin, what urged you to begin to publish African World Analysis over 10 years ago to start that process, and what was the background as far as, you know, getting involved in learning about Pan-Africanism, culture, and things like that prior to, you know, that urge you had to begin to disseminate this information, to publish and disseminate this information?
So my conscious journey started in San Diego, of all places. Actually, let me go all the way back. I'm originally from Detroit, and so grew up on, you know, conscious hip-hop, X-Clan, Public Enemy, KRS, folks like that. And so I had that sort of background. And then I got into the military, unfortunately, and I was in the Navy. And I can remember distinctly, we were on the back, me and, like, you know, about six, seven other brothers, we were on the back of the ship. And there was this one brother who was, you know, leading the discussion. He was in the Nation of Islam. And so that was my first exposure to someone directly face-to-face who was in there in that in the organization who was, you know, sort of connected to some of the music that I was listening to during that time. So I was fascinated. So after some of the talks would be over with, I'd talk to him afterwards. We'd go down to the bunk. He would let me read, you know, the final call and message to the black man. And even then, I mean, in the infancy, if you will, of my growth, I'm reading it, and they're talking about spookism and spook God, and the God is a real God. And that part never stuck with me, but, you know, all of the political stuff and a lot of the historical stuff did. And I never became a card-carrying member, but, you know, I do, you know, give a shout-out to that brother for that personal, you know, one-on-one type of information, final calls, much of the black man, stuff like that. So I get out of the military. I go to San Diego City College, and I go into the cafeteria, and there's just, you know, brothers hanging out, philosophizing and pontificating on Africa stuff, and, you know, I was just like, wow, what's this going on? And so I'm just sitting there because the way I do, when you new to stuff, you shut up and you soak up information like a sponge. And I wish more people followed that. You know, like I know you get some folks that get, you know, be in this about 2 months and then they're ready to get on soapbox. That's that's not how I do. So I was shutting up. I'm sitting at seat, listening and stuff. And so the conversations that always grabbed me was when folks who were challenging Christianity. And, you know, with documentation, not just spouting off stuff. So I was like, okay, cool. So, you know, put a peg in that one. So I started becoming active on campus, the African Student Union, and I hooked up with some other good brothers, and so we then co-founded a community-based organization called the African Culture Society. And so on campus, they were doing a publication called The Drum Code. And the person who was doing it, you know, with college environment, there's a lot of turnover. And so she was like, is there anyone that, you know, wants to learn how to do a drum code because I ain't going to be here all the time? And so, you know, I raised my hand. And so she taught me how to use PageMaker. And so eventually, you know, she would get me articles, I would correct them. And then eventually she moved me into doing the drum code on campus. So that was the literal and actual first foray into me doing news publications dealing with a black audience. And so I just kept that information, even tried to do another one called Connecting Africa's Children when I was president of the ASU. And that, yeah, didn't go too well, but whatever. So years pass, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, I have all of this information, I'm learning this, I'm learning that, what can I do with it? And so 2002 when it started, I was either, I forget if I was still in Chicago or if I had just left, but I was like, let me go ahead and do my own newsletter. And so that was the genesis of Africa World Analysis Issue 1, which I dedicated to Edward Wilmot Blyton. So, you know, I got a picture of him on the front and different quotes from him. I had did a piece on in my linguistics class dealing with the connection between the way we presently speak, quote-unquote, Ebonics and West African language systems, and I had some other good stuff in there. And the response, you know, from it was real good from the Chicago audience. So then when I did eventually moved to D.C., I was like, let me go ahead and keep this up. And so I kept pumping them out, and with a few breaks here and there, most recently, we ain't doing anything for 2013, but like you had said, we have 34 issues now. On our website, there's only 33. There's some technical issues. So if anyone wanted a copy of issue 34, which is a free one, just, you know, hit me up at kamal301@yahoo.com, and I can send that to you. And I am working on issue 35 as we speak, and this one will be dedicated to Marcus Garvey, because, of course, this is the centennial of the UNIA-ACL. And for folks who don't know, it is still going on, the organization. And so this issue is dedicated all to Garvey. And so I've dug up some articles that either folks have written about Garvey concepts or dealing with the membership. I have a real good one talking about outpost Garveyism, where they actually sit and talk with members, you know, OG members of the Garvey movement, and they're, you know, they're squelching rumors and ideas, wrong ideas about Garvey and stuff like that. That's a real good piece, and so I'm sharing that. And a good sister a few years ago, the title of it is A Spiritual Conversation with Marcus Garvey. And so it's like a dialogue. And so she asked a question, and using Garvey's voice, using, you know, pulling together different information from Philosophy and Opinions 1, 2, and 3. There is a 3 out. It's hard to get, but there is a 3 out, as well as his other works. She made it flow like a conversation. So I was really, you know, humbled and cool that she sent that to me to get it published. And so it was supposed. Yeah, so that one will be out. If I stay on course, it should be out in July 1st. And so I'm really looking forward to getting that out, and I'm getting the feedback from people. So, yeah. And I see it keep on going till I can't do it anymore, because every time, what's interesting, I'll shut up here, every time I'm thinking about stopping it because I'm like, okay, folks really ain't into it, or it's getting to be a burden on me, somebody out of the blue, either face-to-face or through an email or phone call, and be like, hey, what's going on with After World Analysis? I really like this issue, and da-da-da, whoop-de-whoop. And to me, I take that as a sign as, okay, dude, you put it out there. You can't quit now. So that keeps me pumping and keep me moving and going on. So, yeah, After World Analysis, still going.
Right, and the thing is, now since you have it, the PDF versions, I know at first, because when you first started, of course, there were, you know, people weren't, 10 years ago, people weren't putting out the PDF versions and putting on websites and things like that. You know, you were printing them out. You were physically going to Kinko's or different places, printing out the journals, you know, producing them and you know, distributing it that way. So now that you have the electronic versions, you know, that is that opening up, you know, the market for them? I know people around the world can have access to them now, where before they didn't have that kind of access.
Right. It's been a mental struggle for me, because I love the internet. I'm on the computer. Folks say I'm on the computer too much. But I still really like tangible things. I like feeling it and touching it. And so it's been a hard transition for me, because like 35, this will probably be the first one, based on some advice actually that you gave me, that won't be 1 through 34, if you get it, it's a online version of the print one, because I was thinking print first and then just making it, you know, available for folks who could do it online or through email or whatever. So making that transition now to where it's just online has been hard, because at one time I did have a, you know, about 10 brothers who were incarcerated, like Brother Malimu Baruti. Like, what I would do is, you know, like you said, I would make the physical copies and I would mail them out to people. And one specific brother, Marlon Mubaruti, that magnificent brother, he would, out in Atlanta, he would send a lot of them to prison, to folks who were in contact with him. So then I would be getting emails from them, and they would want, you know, copies and stuff. And so I would go ahead and send it to them with other information. So I've sort of lost contact with that particular audience, and now by going fully online, I'm sort of even losing that audience even more. So that sort of sucks because I still like the tangible version. But like you say, worldwide audience now and stuff like that. So I'm working with that on my own mental trepidation, but I know that I do fit. And it'll be a lot easier because I won't even bore the audience with all the different dramas and troubles and issues I've had trying to do it online with the print version and all that sort of stuff, those struggles. So doing it, you know, fully formatting it for an online presence right now has been going a lot easier, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, if the dedicated prison audience comes back, you know, then I'll find a way to, you know, do something specific for them. But yeah, online right now is the way I want to go. Yeah, as you see, there's still some trepidation in my voice, but I'm working with it.
Right, and then you can, I mean, some of them, they may be, they may come forward and say they want those print issues, so you might, you know, have a certain amount set aside for just the print, for people who can only access it via print, like in the prison. What made you, you talked about how, you know, you came to the point where you wanted to publish, you know, a periodical. What made you publish this particular format? Because it's almost like a, you know, an Afurakani version of a Newsweek to a certain extent. You deal with truestery, deal with ancestral religion, you'll deal with politics in the community, economics, social issues. So what made you want to use that particular format as opposed to just a one-themed format?
Right. The theme, you know, those had changed. I'm trying to think. I want to say I was, something is jogging my memory. I was in a Black Planet forum a long time ago, and I was sort of, you know, I had through, because, you know, even with Black Planet, with anything, you know, you put out certain ideas and certain folks will gravitate to you and certain folks will leave you alone. And so the good folks that was gravitating to me, if I remember right, it was a sister who had put that bug in my ear to be like, you should do like a newsletter or something with all this, because you're putting all this stuff here in this Black Planet chat. I'm sure you got a whole lot more information. And so then I was like, well, yeah, I do sort of know how to do some stuff from PageMaker back when I was in ASU. And she was like, go on and do it. And so actually, now that I think about it, that was that impetus to get this started from some good folks. Putting the idea in my head in Black Planet chat. And then, like I say, after I did it, then I would make some copies and I'd go around to different places and put them in different bookstores or in other cultural centers, and then go back and then see that they all were gone. Not that they got threw away, but actually, you know, people doing it. And then folks, you know, it always humbles me again when folks who I don't know from Imhotep come up to me and be like, you know, they'll hear the name from however, they'll hear Kamau Mukasey Dehudi, and they'll be like, hey, ain't you the brother to do African World Analysis? Because I've heard that in Chicago, I heard that in San Diego, I've heard that out here, and it's just like, wow. I mean, most recently, when I was at the ASCAT conference, some folks from Tennessee hit me up, and they had heard, you know, me, Africa's Reascension, but they had also, somehow, I still don't know how, they had got wind of African World Analysis down there, and so they hit me up from that, and I was like, whoa. And so it's just always that. It's folks who get a hold to it, they like the information, we cross paths some type of way, and it's like, oh, you're the brother, you're doing good work, keep it up. And so it's like, wow, okay, this is getting to a few folks here and there. And so that added motivation and stuff keeps me going. And the biggest praise that I ever got was from MZ, Asar, Hannibal Last Freak. For folks, you know, who are, again, from Chicago, from folks who are really, really about it as far as nation-building African-centeredness, you all know who MZ, Asar, Hannibal, Afrique is. And I remember one time at up on the lands of the Uncle Bia Society up in Virginia, and he was up there. And he just started, because I would, you know, send him the newsletter down to Mississippi. And, you know, I'm like, he's a activist and doing all this sort of stuff. I don't know if he's reading it or not, if he's just passing it along. But he gave me, at least to date now, the highest praise for the magazine, for the news journal. And, you know, I was just floored that somebody of his stature not only liked it, not only read it, but liked it and praised it that way. And, you know, before he passed, he was just telling me, make sure you keep sending them to me, brother, because there's some good stuff. And I was just floored by it. And so that's some other motivation when I think about, okay, I'm going to just stop it and leave it alone. I just try to play back or at least paraphrase those words from Baba Hannibal. And I'm like, hey, I got to keep doing it. I got to keep going because I know he's watching me and he's giving me that motivation to keep getting the information out there. So, yeah.
Right, and it's not, you know, it's not that many. I mean, you can count on one hand the number of journals, you know, periodicals out there like that. I can't really think of any right now. So, you know what I'm saying? We have to, whenever we have that kind of information and have, you know, that kind of focus that's not tainted with other nonsense where you have to have a caveat every time you suggest it to somebody, you recommend it, like you recommend certain books, recommend certain articles, and you're like, well, it's good information, but watch out for this. At least you don't have to do that, you know, with your work.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, and it's a shame because at this particular point, most of the things that we recommend, there's always a caveat associated with it. So if we find something that we don't have to, you know, give a filter for people, you know, you got to keep putting that up. So now you said this particular issue, How do you structure, when you're putting the information together, how are you, and I always ask this of the guests, how does your ancestral religious practice inform the way you structure the journal and how you approach, you know, putting that information out?
Stuff just comes to me and moves me. It's sad to say, I can't say I have like a full process per se. Like I'm looking at some of the issues, just the front covers of them now. Issue 3, we dedicated that to Steve Biko. Issue 4, you know, it's more what moves me and what's motivating me at that particular time. It like with Garvey, it just seemed apropos to do it during the way we set it up now. We do 4 a year, and so the July, August, September issue would fall with Garvey's birthday. It would fall with the 100th anniversary of the UNIA, so it just seemed to make sense to go ahead and do it that way. But I can't fully say that I have, like, a set process of how I do it, because, like I said, I'm looking through some of the older issues now, and it was, like, you know, what moved me and what motivated me. I had an issue dealing with Stokely Carmichael. Kwame Ture, they had just re-released his book, Stokely Speaks, and so I made sure to put that book, this was back in 2007, so I made sure to put that on the cover, and then the cover of the book on the cover of Afterworld Analysis and pulled an excerpt from it in that particular issue, and I didn't do this on purpose, audience. This was the first time we had an exclusive from you when you were doing your just your Mache Ru broadcast. You had gave me a transcript to Incrabia, and so this particular issue, we put that in there. And then also, I had got a hold of Amos Wilson's last interview, and so that was that ended up being a two-parter. And so this particular issue that I'm talking about that I picked at random, I really did, audience, issue 21, that's part two. So issue 20 is part one of that particular last interview that was given by Amos Wilson. And so it's real. I can honestly say it's just really what moves me and motivates me at that time. Now, I would say more recently I have tried to stay more theme-based in the sense that the 2009 issue, issue 26, Obama had just become president, and I was like, oh, my God, this gonna make everyone crazy. So every piece, first, issue 26 was when we expanded it to larger than 8 pages, but every particular article in there was dealing with the insanity that Obama was actually going to do something for us. Issue 27 was a book review edition. I did an in-depth analysis of the great work Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. I did another in-depth analysis of the magnificent work Reinventing Africa by Ifeoma Deume. And again, I'm not doing this on purpose. You had also shared Afro-Kaitni ancestral religion, and so I shared a piece of that in issue 27. Issue 28, one that I really, really liked just personally, because that was when I was able to really, that was, I need to get back to this, to really sit down and do articles. This one was called Being African, and every piece in there is dealing with different aspects of being African. So the lead piece is my piece on the road to complete African ideational sovereignty. An examination of the African way with a special emphasis on African cosmology. And I just really, really like that piece, and I can't wait to create more time so I can do a follow-up to that. And then we've got African Inclusive Epistemology by Sister Tewede Grills and the African Meaning of Human Beingness by Wade Nobles. So as you see, as we expanded the issues, we started getting more direct with themes. Issue 29, I am really, really proud of as well. And since we have at least one good sister who I know of in the chat room, I could definitely share this one. Issue 29 was our liberation-minded women's issue. Every article is coming from a powerful sister, and then the centerpiece of the news journal is, I want to say, maybe 30 books or so written by African-centered minded women. And, you know, I just give you the cover and the author and the title, and so you can see it. And you know, it's almost one of those who knew in that sense that all this good work was out there, not only by women, but also liberation-minded women. And so, of course, I got a piece in there by Dr. Rimba Ani, To Be an African Woman, Definition of Womanhood by Ancestor Nzinga Warfield Kopic, Implications for Future Research on African and African-American Women by Niara Sujarkasa. And then a good sister, you know her as well, Moot Kentake, she submitted a piece dealing with the single life, Urugu insanity, or African reality. And so issue 29 is just dedicated to liberation-minded women. All the information, all the books shared are of that same vein. And so, you know, the themed piece started coming when we expanded it to from 40 to 52 pages. So issue 30, African Spiritual Redemption 1, everything in there dealing with African spirituality from an uncut, raw, unapologetic African stance. Issue 31 is another one, African Spiritual Redemption Part 2, Issue 32, African Identity Redemption. Every piece, every quote, everything dealing with our African identity. When I had the debate with Osiris Imhotep, you know, I have what I put together in there. And then some other good pieces, again, another piece on African identity by Mama Aje, Mama Queer Koto, and a good piece on African identity, the consciousness of self from Wade Nobles. That one was 52 pages. That was fun to put together. And so, yeah, so as they kept going, they were more themed that way. And I may stick with that, but again, just to be honest, when I'm putting together is basically how I'm moved, what's going on, what I see is important at that particular time. So yeah.
And then what happened once you began to expand the journal, expand the periodical, introducing people to authors that we typically don't very often hear of, like. People would think that the only women who know anything about Afro-Arakani, Afro-Arakani culture is, you know, Marimba Ani and Dr. Welsing, and that's about it, you know what I'm saying? So
right.
There are a lot of people out there who are putting information out, and they just don't get, you know, that kind of, you know, exposure. So your periodical is, you know, exposing people to information coming from people, our people here as well as around the world. But then you moved into expanding your reach with regard to media by starting the Blog Talk radio show, Africa's Reascension. So how did that come about, and how's that helping you get the word out that you started with the journal, the periodical, but then you went to the mass media with the broadcast?
So when I first moved to D.C., I was a happy card-carrying member of the UNIAACL chapter here, and it was vibrant, and it was going on, and they was about to do big things. They was even moving in the direction of making me the Minister of Education for the D.C. chapter so we could do some things. They had a bill and all that sort of stuff. I don't think I can get into all the stuff that has happened since then, but I bring that up to say that my first ever hearing a mention of Blog Talk was they had brought in a brother, I forget where he's from, I don't know if it's Senegal or somewhere else, but his name is Jacques Agboten, A-G-B-O-T-E-N, and he had written a very, very good book dealing with, you know, Pan-Africanism, and you know, of course, he had Garvey and Nkrumah and other stuff in there, and so hearing him speak forcefully, and then seeing this book, I was like, whoa. And so he had mentioned something called Blog Talk Radio, and I was like, I never heard of that. And so he did do a few shows, and I listened to it. It was cool. So that was my first hearing of Blog Talk Radio. The first time, and so then, so, you know, he stopped doing it, and so then I did some searches, you know, I think I put in Africa or Black or something like that to find some other shows, saw some shows. And so there was a good brother who did a show called Holipsism's Haven. And he used to be on Sundays from 9 o'clock. And it was real, you know, critical, just common sense type of African-centered progressive information. And he was a down-to-earth brother and all that, and I was like, wow. And so I would listen to his show basically every Sunday. That became a ritual. And would call in, and we made a connection and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And so there was a brother who came on the show and was talking about we're more American than African. And I was like, what? And so I called into the show, and I was like, I challenge you to a debate. Are you serious? We are Africans. I don't know what the heck you talk about. And so, you know, and so this was the first debate that had happened on Holicism's show. And so this was that great identity debate that we talked about. And so that was, you know, like the first time that I was on Blog Talk Radio outside of, you know, just calling in, asking questions or giving comments or stuff. And so then, so that debate went well. Most folks say I crushed him, and it is, you know, if for folks that, you know, want to judge for themselves, we have it up in our archives at Africa's Reascension here at Blog Talk, so you can check it out for yourself. So Mr. Holicism, he was like, you know what, I've been doing this for 2 years, I'm ready to do some other stuff. And so, you know, he was giving shout-outs to me and other folks, and he was like, hey, I think y'all should pick up this mantle. And so, you know, started playing around, looking at money, looking at time, and I was like, you know what, all right, let's give it a try. And so September, I want to say 2010, was our first show. And so, you know, in a few months, we'll be going on 4 years now. And so it's been a, outside of the dang own glitches that Blog Talk does, and outside of, so Blog Talk used to be, if you could believe it, Blog Talk used to be free for everybody. And for 2 hours, you could do it, you know. And so then they saw all these people coming, so then they was like, okay, we're going to charge. And so everybody had to decide if they wanted to pay or if they wanted to stay free but then just be confined to 30 minutes and 3 uploads and all that sort of stuff. And so I was like, okay, I'll go ahead and pay. And so, you know, I started it. Well, before I decided I was going to pay, I was going to do a show for 2 hours under the house of someone else. And I won't get into all those details, but that fell through due to some, I still feel some janky dealings from that particular person who I still ain't spoke with since. And so then I decided, okay, screw it. I'll just pay for my own and do it that way. And so that's been that. And as far as getting the word out, you know, to be honest, I could still do a better job of that. I need to do more commercials for the particular products that I do. I also just don't want folks to think that I'm only doing the show to get you to buy the products, because I hate folks like that. As they say in the street, I'm about this life. You know, this is who I am, and I just so happen to do other things, other related things, hopefully to make some money versus, you know, and you know folks like that too, who are just in it to make money, but they don't really care about all the information, all that other sort of stuff. So I just never want to be labeled that way. And so that has sort of, I would be honest and say, held me back in doing the marketing arm a little bit better. But doing more commercials, just to let folks know about Afterworld Analysis, about cafepress.com/Kamau301, where I'm trying to, you know, have different Africa-centered T-shirts and, well, at least something to promote Africa's Reascension, the overall business, Bole Kaja Enterprises, as well as other stuff. So, you know, I got a T-shirt and a hat, and you can get mugs and book bags and stuff with our logo on it and things like that. But, yeah, I can do, I will do a better job on that in the future, as long as the commercials and the ads and all that don't overtake the show and the message of the show. As long as I can keep that balanced in, I'll feel better. But right now, I'll admit I am lagging on the marketing arm of all the other stuff that I do. But once the new book comes out, which hopefully sometime in this year, it's the new book is basically just a collection of different essays, articles, and speeches that I did from like 95 to about 2000. But I there's been a lot, and so it's, you know, it's going to be about 200 some odd pages. And so once I launch this new thing, with an already, you know, an audience that knows me from being around for some time, and with, you know, close to 300 friends on FaceAIA book and stuff like that, I think this launch and this marketing aspect will be better because I've been in it and, you know, I've tested a few things and see what's failed. And so once the new book gets launched, then I'll really focus more on the marketing aspect and intertwining that into Africa's Reascension. So, yeah.
Okay. No, we appreciate that. And we, you know, like you said, you even back then when you looked through the different shows that might exist on the network, on the platform. You didn't see that many. Even today where you have a lot of shows, you know, a lot of shows that have the word Africa in them, you know what I'm saying, or spirituality in them. There's a plethora of shows, but when you actually investigate, there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of nonsense out there. So, you know, the more people, you know, listen to the way you were able to establish this, you know, venue to get your information out, we need more people who are really focused, really have real information. We need to have shows, you know, through every day of the week, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with real information coming out as opposed to, you know, we're being swamped by nonsense. So we just have to keep the, you know, you got to keep your show going, keep your periodical going, and then we're inspiring other people to, you know, establish shows on Ustream. We do need to have a 24-hour network where it's constantly every subject matter available, imaginable. We are getting the word out from an Afrakani, Afrakani perspective, a real perspective, as opposed to a lot of the science.
Right.
So let me say before I just want to let people know, if you want to call in, if you're already on the phone, if you have a question, you can raise your hand now at any time. Press 1 to raise your hand. In the chat room, if you have questions, you can ask questions. You can start asking them now. What were you saying? Go ahead.
Yeah, two quick things. One, I have to give a shout out at least to the old. He sort of changed now, but the old. And I hope if you listen to this, you don't take offense to this. Chidi Obiawadu, because when he first started up Living in Black. .com. That was a strong push for me to do my own show, because when he first started out, that's what it was. It really was 24-hour conscious internet radio. And so you could log into his thing at any time, and you might hear some Amos, you might hear some Dr. Clark, you might hear some John G. Jackson. I was like, well, so I was, you know, just a dedicated person listening to that. So then when he changed that format over, and, you know, it was sort of, I understood it because, you know, that takes a lot of work to do that, constantly putting on stuff all the time. And every now and then, you know, you would set stuff up to play and then go to sleep, and then sometimes stuff would mess up. And, you know, so that takes a lot of work. And so I sort of understood his change of format from doing that, but it sort of sucked because I just really, really liked it. And so even though I, you know, you can't do the 24-hour format on Blog Talk, I definitely have to give him a shout-out for, again, opening up the whole conscious internet Blog Talk, the conscious internet radio programs just in general, that idea. And you know, I call him, I personally just call him the grandfather, if you will, of conscious internet radio. Now, like I say, there has been some changes. He's Chef Keaty now, and he focuses more on healthy eating and gardening and stuff like that, which is good, and that is needed. But, you know, there was one time where he was a bit more expansive and more directly African-centered than he is now. But I also understand that everybody can't do everything, so you have to, you know, fulfill certain niches and be the best in those particular niches. And he's doing, you know, pretty good work, if not great work, in, you know, healthy living, healthy eating, stuff like that. And then the second point I quickly want to make, since we were talking about, a lot of folks may not know all the different sisters who are writing books and stuff. If you'll indulge me, like I said, I had books for scholar, activist, warrior women. And if you'll indulge me, if I could just read the authors and titles of those books, and so ideally, maybe that'll get folks to get those, that get Africa World Analysis issue 29, the liberation-minded woman's issue, or hearing these book titles may motivate you to go try to dig up these books. Would that be okay? Could I read through these books real quick?
Yeah, definitely.
Just the titles, okay. So I have everything from Ife Amadeume. So that's Reinventing Africa, Ifeoma Adeyemi, African Matriarchal Foundations, Daughters of the Goddess, and Daughters of Imperialism, and a good book to shut up the gender-confused folks who are attempting to use Africa to say that it's always been here. She squashes that very well in Male Daughters and Female Husbands. So Ife Amadeume, I recommend all of her stuff. We also have both books by Nzinga Warfield Kopic, Afrocentric Theory and Application, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And in those, she actually goes through rites of passage programs. And I think one of those is specifically dedicated to creating those four girls going into women. So one is a broad understanding of Afrocentric theory, but I think the second one, if I'm not mistaken, is specifically dedicated to creating rites of passage systems and stuff for women and helping girls become women and stuff like that. We highlighted the book A Voice from the South by Anna Julia Cooper, of course Asada by Asada Shakur, Taste of Power by Elaine Brown, Black Women, Feminism, and Black Liberation, Which Way? By Vivian Gordon. A lot of the feminists hate that book because she looks at feminism, she critiques it, and she says, throw that crap in the garbage can and follow Black Liberation. It's a small book, but it's a powerful, powerful book. Decolonizing Methodologies by a sister named Thuwe Smith. She is a Maori, Maori from New Zealand, and the whole book is her walking through how to look at indigenous realities, how to use it in the classroom, how to de-link it from the European stuff. That book is just a magnificent book. I really, really like that one, Decolonizing Methodologies. Of course, the classic Criminalizing a Race by Shashi McIntyre. Black Womanhood, that's an edited book by Barbara Thompson. But the reason why I know about that one is because Sister Ifeoma Adeyemi has a magnificent article inside of that. Of course, both of Dr. Maureen Barney's books, Let the Circle Be Unbroken and Urugu, Fighting the Slave Trade, that one is edited by Sylvain Joff. For folks who don't know, we fought enslavement on the continent, and we unfortunately lost, but we don't even know that we fought on the continent. We fought the fools that was trying to kidnap us, as well as the white folks that was, you know, coming in too. And so she walks through, it's an edited piece, so it's a lot of different voices, but she edited that piece to let folks know that we were fighting the slave trade. They didn't just come over and take us, oh, no, we was trying to fight. Freedom Given, Freedom Won. That's a good book dealing with Brazilian freedom fighters. Of course, the ISIS papers, Francis Cress Wilson. Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement by Barbara Ransby. Ida, talking about the biography of Ida B. Wells by Paula Giddens. But I also have Crusade for Justice by Sister Ida. I always recommend, if you want to know about somebody, first get their words. First get their speeches, their lectures and all that, and then supplement that with biographies and other folks talking about them. So that way you're rooted in what they had to say and their ideologies first. And then when you get the biographies, you always got to understand other folks are going to put their stuff in on that particular person. And so if you root yourself in who they are, then you can navigate the biographies and other books a little bit better. Finding Soul on the Path to Orisha by Tobe Malore Correll. There's a few problematic things in that book, but I just, like you were saying earlier, we sometimes got to do that caveat, but I just like that book because it's a personalized approach to a sister getting into Ifa and all those type of practical questions that you're going to ask yourself when you move out of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and move to a African system, all those type of questions that you deal with. It's a real personalized book, and so I really like that. Akan Protocol and the Quest for Spiritual Transformation by my Nana, Nana Kwia Opokuwa from Ghana. The Quest for Spiritual Transformation is the first book, even technically I think it predates some of it may predate some of your stuff on the way that the econ system is practiced, the way that Denny Zulu the first brought it, and we know all your information, so you ain't got to go in on that. But you know, she wrote the first book breaking down how to do the religion and stuff like that, the way that he brought it over to us. We highlighted that book. Understanding an Afrocentric Worldview by Linda James Myers, Negritude Women by Sister Sharpley Whiting, and then a magnificent book, Radiance from the Waters by Sylvia Boone, looking at the secret societies of the Poro people. Oh, dang, this is humor. I'm sorry. Why Black Men Choose White Women by Rosie Milligan. And you know Sister Rosie from Chicago, so, you know, hardcore, just straight up, you know, type of sister. I really liked her energy when I was out there. We had that book. Falling Out of Grace and Welcoming Spirit Home by Sobhonfu Somay, and we know she's got that crazy chapter in one of those about the gatekeepers. We won't talk about that now. Wonderful Ethiopians of the Ancient Kushite Empire by Drusilla Dungy Houston, The Strength of Our Mothers by Niara Sujurkasa. That's a magnificent book where she fuses together African and African-American women and their lifestyle. Our Mothers, Our Power, Our Texts by Teresa Washington. Of course, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joyce DeGruy DeLeary. Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington, and Sacred Woman by Queen Afua. So those were the books that's the centerpiece of our liberation-minded woman's issue. And since you brought it up, I just want to, you know, expand the base of women so folks know that there are sisters out there that's writing. They are writing some powerful stuff. Unfortunately, we just got to dig and find it. And as you can tell, those books cover the spectrum. You know, medical apartheid, all the crap that white folks have done and are doing to us. And it's very interesting when I worked at the Caucasian bookstore. And this is no disparagement to the incredible story of Henrietta Lacks or whatever the full title is, but it just always upset me that both of those books, that and Medical Apartheid, came out at about the same time, but everybody was running to the Henrietta Lacks book. And I was like, what's up with that? And so somebody broke it down to me. They was like, it's easier for white folks to deal with just one person and one bad thing that happened to one person versus looking at the entire system. And that's why, I mean, because they were creating book groups about the Henrietta Lacks book, and it was flying off the shelves, and Medical Apartheid might have sold two or three or four, you know, in that particular store in a week or whatever. And so when the person broke it down to me that way, I was like, oh, okay, they don't like looking at themselves in a system-wide context. It's a, you know, oh, they did wrong, they stole her sales, you know, they can have that individuated guilt, but they don't want to expand that guilt to the whole system of psychiatry and medical practice. And so, but I'm rambling now. But, yeah, those are just some of the books we highlighted in After World Analysis, issue 29, for anyone that's interested.
Oh, man, I'll say, because we need to, you know, we need to know all of these various authoresses out here. And once you see them, then they'll lead you to even more so we can bring that balance.
Right.
You know, the perspective of any aspect of culture that we're trying to embrace and get some, you know, insight into. We can't just have this, we can't take the Christian Islamic Hebrew mindset, patriarchal, homosexual, dissexual mindset of there is no woman or woman is inferior, and plug that into something, a pseudo-Afrocentric, you know, worldview, where it's just men teaching things and women are just going along with it. Whether it's right or wrong, it's just nonsense. And well, that's what we have done. So, you know, we say merase for, you know, expanding people's view and getting that accurate information out there. So what we want to do now is we want to go into your book, your first book, How to Make a Negro Christian. And, well, just talk about how you – you know, started, what made you write the book? I know you initially were talking about, you know, you were interested, even when you were back in the Navy, about any time they were talking about the origins of Christianity. What made you decide, okay, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to expose this period during the near the end of enslavement in North America and afterwards, where they began to, you know, force Christianity on us, and they came up with this method, the religious instruction of the Negro, why they came up with it, and how they, you know, began to disseminate that perverse information into our community. What made you move on that subject at that particular time period for your first book?
I take it back to, I was at San Diego State at the time, and I was in the class of a good teacher, and he had played a Dr. Clark clip. And Dr. Clark had mentioned that, you know, because he sometimes just rattled off books and stuff like that, and so he had mentioned that this guy, this Reverend Charles Colcock Jones, had did a primer on how to get us Christianity. And, you know, out of everything that was said, that really stuck with me. And I remember even making notes about it and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't think too much of it again. And then so I leave San Diego, a whole bunch of stuff, leave Chicago. I come to D.C. And one of the first places that I knew I was going to go and spend a whole bunch of time in was the Library of Congress. And for anyone that's outside of D.C. Who has heard the myth, let me squelch the myth now. The Library of Congress does not house every single book that was ever printed. I have attempted to come and get some good African-centered book titles or whatever, and they just don't have it. So they do not have every single book that's ever been published. I just want to get out there. But so I get to the Library of Congress, get the reader card and all that, and then it hit me again. I was like, oh, yeah, Dr. Clark was talking about this primer to give us Christianity. Let me see if it's here. And so it was there. And so I checked it out, and, you know, I'm reading it, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And so I saw the value of it immediately, the religious instruction of the Negro. And so I went ahead, saved some money, and even at 20 cents a page, I ain't care, I copied the whole book. And so I was like, okay, folks don't know about this. I got to get this out to people, how to do it. And so I checked the date, and, you know, so it was in public domain, and so I could reprint it if I wanted to. And so that was the first impetus and thought. Dr. Clark said his piece. I come out to D.C., go to the Library of Congress, they have the book, I photocopy the whole book, and I'm reading it, and mine is just blown, gray matter all over the place. I go through, I find out, okay, I can't reprint it. So I'm doing more study on him, and then I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, he did an updated piece. So the original sermon he did in 1832, and then there's a book of the same name. Then he goes around. So he does this sermon. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Yeah, you're talking about me and the book. Okay, so let me do that. So I then find out that he did an updated piece in 1847 called Suggestions for the Religious Instruction of the Negro. And so I was like, ooh, okay, let me get a hold of that one too. And he even has a catechism. And for anyone who hasn't hopefully and happily been indoctrinated with Catholicism, a catechism is basically a book full of questions and answers. And that you have a question and there's one correct answer and everyone is supposed to give you back that answer. So when you look through this book, the whole book is nothing but questions and answers or questions and the acceptable answer. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I have to get all of this in here. And so the original first idea was just to reprint these documents because I was like, folks got to know about this. It's too old. It's a public domain. Don't nobody know about this. But then I was like, you know what? I hate books. I personally hate books that lay out the problem very, very well, but have two or three pages of solutions or half solutions or partial solutions. So I went back to the well, and I was like, you know what? I need to do some analysis. I need to do some commentary with this, as well as I need to then offer folks a way out. I need to offer folks some solutions. If they agree with all this information and they see Christianity as a bunch of crap, then what's the next step? And so then I had to sit down and, you know, figure out how to write that and put it together and pull resources together and stuff like the bibliography of those resources, stuff like that. And so that was the full mindset to put the book. It got sparked by Dr. Clark, and I was just like, let me go ahead and move forward on this. And so so the way we got it broke down is the introduction, and then the life of Reverend Charles Colcock Jones. Because at the time, this came out in 2006, Willie Lynch was all up and down everybody's mouths. Every other book that was written was dealing with Willie Lynch or whatever, whatnot. And only a few folks were asking, is he really real? And so within that particular chapter, you know, it's nothing elaborate. It's not a full biography of him. I just pulled together different information from different and independent, and that's the key phrase, independent sources to let folks know that this is a real person. And if I was to do an updated version of it, there would be even more independent sources from, you know, that reference him, that talk about him in different ways, shapes, or forms. So I wanted to make it undeniable that Reverend Charles Colcock Jones did exist, and I even got a picture of him there. And then we lay out the full religious destruction of the Negro, and a majority of the updated piece, the suggestions to religious destruction of the Negro. And I did it specifically that way because I hate folks that think that you are soundbiting people, or that, well, you see, that's wrong, brother. See, if you read the whole passage, they meant this and this and that. You know how the Christians love to do. You hit them with a scripture, and then that saying something that they don't want you to say, and so then they say, well, you got to read the whole thing. So I was like, to get away from that, here's the whole thing. You can read it for yourself. And then after you read the whole thing, then I have my commentary and my analysis and my other stuff. And so I do that for both of those documents. And then I was like, you know what, I have to give folks some solutions. So after all of that, then you have beginning the reconnection to our African spiritual greatness. And so inside that, precursors to diasporic African spiritual conquest, African spiritual reconnection 101, and I give a page, considerations for participating with or joining African spiritual houses. Then we got the conclusion. And then in the appendix is where I give just a few pages of that catechism. And so the whole title is Catechism of Scripture, Doctrine, and Practice for Families and Sabbath Schools Designed Also for the Oral Instructions of Colored People. That's that whole title. And so, again, that catechism is just very, very interesting because he was doing all this in the 1800s, y'all. And to hear some of the responses, you hear the same sort of stuff. Question, what did Jesus work out for us guilty sinners? Answer, everlasting righteousness. What question, what is his name whereby he shall be called? Answer, the Lord our righteousness. And it's just, you read some of these Q&As back when he did it in the 1800s, and you go to some of these Negro churches today, and you will hear these same type of responses. And so while I do make mention that while he was living, Colcock Jones, his efforts didn't see fruition then. But as I say, he created the template. He created the justification. He created the backbone for the structure for the continuation of us being Christianized. And so the work of Carter G. Woodson, his history of the Negro church, his education of the Negro. And see, both of those, I think, if I'm not mistaken, are before miseducation of the Negro. And I love miseducation, but it just irks me that everyone talks about miseducation, and they just skip over the book that preceded that, which was Education of the Negro. And I think one of the reasons why folks jump over that book is because he lays it out. The majority, if not the totality of our education at that time was solely Christian-based, was solely Bible-based. That's part of the reason why we're so stuck in Christianity to this day. In slavery and quote-unquote post-chattel slavery, that is literally almost all that we knew. And so I guess folks don't like to read about themselves and see that critique, and so that's why they skip over education and just deal with miseducation. But he was going through and looking at numbers, and you know, they really didn't have us in the census pre-1900. But when they did do the census, he found out that right at around 1900, almost 70% of us was Christians. And so I'm like, wait a minute. And in this short amount of time, from when Charles did his thing, 1832, to 1900, when they finally started taking numbers, over 70% of black folks at that time became Christian, when we know we didn't start out that way. When we know when they dropped us off on the boats, we were Yoruba or Mende or Khan or Igbo or Ibobo, you know, whatever. We were doing that. And so in just that short period of time, we overwhelmingly, then and now, are Christian. And from my analysis, I just put that to the footwork of Charles Colcock Jones and the template that he laid out. And I'm sure you'll set me up to go more in depth with that, but I'll stop right there and let you maybe play a commercial or a break or something so we can catch our breath.
Okay, let me hold on 1 second. Let me pull this up right quick. But, yeah, so I mean, it's one of the things that stuck out with me with the book is, you know, you have people who say, well, I go to church because, well, they believe that they were going to church because, you know, the Lord led them to church and things like that. And then when they hear people say, well, no, Christianity was forced on us, they say, well, no, it wasn't forced on me. That's just the way the Lord led me. But then when you get the actual detailed, methodical process that they went through to incorporate that, especially that catechism with the question and answer, and even the title of the catechism, talking about this is for the oral instruction of the Negroes. You know what I'm saying? And you can't deny, they can't deny what was going on. It's right there in black and white for them, and they're repeating, like you said, the exact same answer. But hold on 1 second. Let me see if I can pull this up. For the people in the call queue, if you have a question, you can ask. You can just hit number one. Raise your hand now if you have any questions for Kamal. I'm trying to pull up this this piece right quick. Okay. And we're going to take a quick break, a couple of minutes, and we'll be right back. Wanted to take a little break right quick. Okay, so we're back with Kamal Mukasey Tahuti. For those who are just joining in the chat and joining on the phone call queue, the number is 657 383 1-800-795-0635 if you have a question for Kamau. Kamau is the publisher of African World Analysis. He's also the publisher and author of How to Make a Negro Christian, and also, as you just heard on the commercial, the host of his own show on Blog Talk Radio on Sunday nights, Africa's Reascension. So we were getting into, and you can order the book on lulu.com/Kamau301, How to Make a Negro Christian. And his website is African World Analysis. That's African with a K, AfricanWorldAnalysis.com. That's where you can order the all the back issues of the periodical. There are about 34 back issues right now. You can order the PDF versions of those. Very inexpensive, I believe, like $3 per issue. So let's get back to the publication. So some of your commentary on the first portion with the first sermon that Colcock Jones put forward and published with regard to the instruction, the religious instruction of the Negro, how the whites and offspring decided at first they weren't going to, you know, teach us anything about Christianity. Then they decided this is the best way to have docile slaves, slave-minded individuals where we can control them. The best way to do that is to teach them Christianity. So talk about that, you know, that first sermon, and then your commentary in the book on the sermon. You publish the whole sermon in total, and then you give commentary on the sermon.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's I could pull out one good one. This is on yeah, this is from the original Religious Instruction of the Negroes. Colcock says, "And having our plantations, the time and persons of our servants wholly under our control, we can arrange the manner and frequency of our instructions as we please, and the period of these instructions with as much punctuality and with as little interruption as we can arrange the morning and evening devotions of our own fireside. Check this out. Our very children might become to some extent teachers by reading to them plain portions of the Bible or plain tracts and things of that sort." I was just like, I didn't even really have a good commentary for that. I was like, that was just self-explanatory. Y'all should see that one. Where's another good one? There's some real good ones here. It's funny, when you read, like, biographies about him, about Colcock, they would call him a friend of the Negro, the apostle of the blacks. Those are some of the titles that folks had bestowed upon him. But then when you actually read how he thought about us, you're like, is this a friend? And so I move to this quote where he says, he's talking about us now, "They are an ignorant and wicked people, from the oldest to the youngest. Hence, instruction should be committed to them all and communicated intelligibly, that it may be impressed upon their memories and good order promoted amongst them. It should be communicated frequently and at stated intervals of time." Stated intervals of time, Sundays, all the time at 11 maybe? And what's some other good ones? I mean, yeah, here we go. "The benefits." He lays out the benefits. "The benefits of the religious instruction of the Negro is as follows. 1, there will be a better understanding of the mutual relations of master and servant. 2, there will be greater subordination and a decrease of crime amongst the Negro. 3, most unpleasant discipline will be saved to the churches. 4, the church and society at large will be benefited. 5, the souls of our servants will be saved. And 6, we shall relieve ourselves of a great responsibility." I was just like, wow. But now, check this out. this one even gets more at the matter. He says something, a key lesson that Caucasoids learned early on, is he made the statement, "Obedience, quote, obedience will never be felt and performed to the extent that we desire it unless we can bottom it on religious principle." And so I say if you read it a slightly different way, to get a Negro to believe or follow something tied to Christianity or tell him Jesus endorses it, these putrid tricks still work and are used against us today. I mean, so in that beginning, I can't forget this one. Some of the, in this original piece, he is laying out stuff, and it's just point blank. And that's why I was like, I was just floored when I read it, and I was like, I have to get this to people, because in my head, you know, maybe a bit naive, well, if people see the truth and it's point blank in their face, they'll be leaving the church in droves, you know. Maybe, you know, just get it out to more people, maybe that'll happen, but still. Again, here's another quote. Again, have we not heard individual planters say that some of their best servants are those who profess religion and appear to have the root of the matter in them? And so I say profess religion explicitly means profess the tenets of Christianity. When spiritual colonization is complete, one submits to European power and control as if divine. And so when folks like Kwesi and myself and others question Christianity from our different vantage points, folks think that we are saying that God don't exist. And on one level, I would say we're saying that God don't exist. They made that up. But on a whole nother level, I mean, you still see that. You can't question God. We're not. We are saying that this system is some BS that was hoisted on us against our will, especially during a time that we couldn't fight against it, because he just said we got them wholly under our control, so we can do whatever we want, how we want, for how long we want, and they can't do nothing about it. And so he's just pulling it point blank. There never, another quote, there never will be a better state of things until the Negroes are better instructed in religion. So he just knew. And that was, like you had mentioned, that it took a while for, and all of them, all the Caucasoids didn't buy into his plan, but it took a while for Caucasoids to actually say, okay, let's go ahead and give them Christianity. On one level, you know, I wish they wouldn't have, but they went ahead and did it. And so once he got that charge to go ahead and do it and it was okay, he would go from plantation to plantation, giving his ideas, sometimes delivering the sermon. You know, sometimes the enslaved African owners ain't want to hear it, and they would run him off the plant, off of their plantations. But, you know, more than not, there was acceptance. And there were a few other people. And so, yeah, let me be clear. There were a few other people. If you research this period in time, there were a few other people. One I list, his name was Pinckney, and one other that I can think of who was trying to put together this idea of how do we give Christianity to our enslaved African people. But then when you keep looking at the documentation, especially, you know, past when Colcock passed, you find people going back and quoting him over again. When you look into some of Pinckney's documents, they knew each other. So you know, they was bouncing ideas off of each other back and forth on how to do this and how to do that. So they were contemporaries, and they knew each other. Or if you read some other folks' books on how to do it, they will go back and reference Colcock Jones. So, again, even though his efforts weren't fully, you know, blossomed and flowered during his time, folks took up the mantle because he did the legwork. He did probably the most footwork and the most writing down and stuff of how to do this than other people did. And so folks just took his work and his template and moved forward. And we unfortunately see those fruits today. And so, as I sort of alluded to, so this is 1832. He did this original sermon, and then there's a book of the same name, and that's what we reprint. And so, like I just said, he goes from plantation to plantation. So the folks who accepted it, they went ahead and tried it. So he goes back to these plantations, or folks are now starting to send him letters and correspondences, or they're seeking him out. and they've got questions, and they've got objections, and they've got concerns. So he was like, you know what? I think I got to update this. And so then in 1847, 16 years later, that's when he did his suggestions on the religious instructions of the Negro in the southern states. And that's where he goes through, and I would say, especially when you get into my commentary, you see that he gets even more specific. More specific in the sense, in one sense, he breaks it down, the best ways to religiously instruct, I would say confuse, adults, and how to do it to children. And then he even goes through and walks through more specifics as far as the best times. And so I can, you know, if I can go ahead and get into some of that if you'd like. Just trying to find some real good ones.
Now, so, yeah, let's see. Jumped out at me when you listed the six, you know, reasons that he laid out of why it would be so effective to, you know, force this nonsense on us. When he said it would, you know, reduce crime, it would increase subordination, and then it would reduce crime. And some people would read that and say, well, they're just trying to teach our people to be moral and obedient and to the Lord and reducing crime so we won't be stealing and theft and all that. When the whites in their offspring are trying to reduce crime amongst the people they enslave, that means they're trying to reduce us from revolting against them and killing them. So the best way to stop a revolt and increase subordination, meaning keep them slaves, and to them a crime is for us to free ourselves from slaves. That's the greatest crime they could imagine. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
And just the way he laid it out. And the sermon is like over 30 pages, the first sermon. So it's not like he just came up with an idea. That's, you know, it's very extensive. So that's what jumped out with me when I was, you know, looking through that information.
Yeah, and it gets even worse. that's where is it? So I talk about from pages 13 to 23 using numbers of these the updated spiritual instructions. Reverend Colcott goes into details on how effective ministering to the Negro should look. The Negro adult, to be specific, which we've labeled how to spiritually trap Negro adults. And then he lays out on pages 23 to 27, he outlines how to properly minister to Negro children and youth, which we labeled how to spiritually trap Negro children and youth. And so some of the ones under the adults, he should preach on the Sabbath at least once to the Negroes of his church, the particular part of day to be selected for the service of the Negroes. The manner of preaching should, of course, be the pure word of God. The style of speaking should be dignified and simple. The manner of preaching must depend upon the constitutional peculiarities. For permanent impression and for the promotion of intelligence and piety, the public worship of God should be conducted with reverence and stillness. An inquiry meeting should be had, and then he no doubt will appoint a lecture or prayer meeting or both according to his convenience and ability. And then he has some other ones too. But then with the child, I mean, again, you talk about the level of detail that he lays out with this. And under the children, and this connection will be formed early in the life of the children of his flock. He will have the children of his colored members regularly presented for baptism. Next, as soon as their age admits it, the child will be brought under pastoral instruction. As soon as the age permits, Next, his path of instruction will not be complete without the establishment of Sabbath schools, Sunday school. 1847, yo. The minister should not be satisfied with the Sabbath school or schools established in his church or churches. He will endeavor to have similar schools established in destitute neighborhoods. And then as the minister, basically, make sure that the religious instruction is also done at the home. And so when you go to the, if the enslaved African owner goes to the house of people who was in his church, they will make sure that these lessons are from the parent are being passed to the child. There's a word in there that I couldn't put that to it. I couldn't pronounce, so I wanted to butcher it. And so my commentary is, you know, whether or not those instructions and everything were followed exactly to the letter, that's not the germane issue. The fact that this Caucasoid took the time and energy to sit, think, and apply it during his time is the real issue. And as I've been saying earlier, it seems that he created the template for which all after him or of like minds were to follow. His foresight and long thought set the standards for how once proud Africans would praise the abominable Jesus. Things have been tweaked from 1847 to now, but Dr. Jones created the parameters, the foundation, and the groundwork for all other Christian brainwashers to follow. But like I say, he... Now, again, some of this, when you look at it now versus when it was actually done, there has been some change in deviation. Like one of the suggestions is, he has a suggestion, and I quote, against any noise or wild or riotous conduct, such as hallelujahing, loud conversations, boisterous laughter, merrymaking, drinking, trading, racing, quarreling, or fighting around or in the vicinity of the place of public worship. And so my commentary is, it is interesting to see how some of these denominations, seem to follow this to the letter, while others threw it out completely. The Baptist and Apostolic faith, and for the Apostolic, those are like the Jesus Robics or the Jesus or size, you know, where they all jump in hoop and holler. They hoop and holler from beginning to end, while the Methodist and Lutheran types, you could hear a pin fall on cotton during their particular sermons. I continue, he also exhorted against drinking within the vicinity of places of public worship, and we know that that's been a complete failure. While this writer commented earlier about the explosion of churches on nearly every other block in the African community, close to just as offensive is the explosion of liquor stores next door or in close proximity to all these other churches. So, again, even though everything may not have gotten followed exactly to the letter, we can definitely see how a lot of it, the majority of it, is still being enacted to this very day based on the work that Colcock put together.
And even the this you're showing that he was going from, you know, plantation to plantation to spread the word, spread the sermon, spread the method. And then you have Negro preachers today who are going on revivals where they go from city to city or church to church, and they're thinking that, you know, this is just, you know, what we're doing, the Lord's work. What they're doing is going from plantation to plantation, replenishing the enslavement of the minds of the people enslaved. They're just following what Colcock was doing with his, you know, traveling from plantation to plantation to maintain enslavement.
Yes. And this is a great segue into this particular quote. And this quote was so powerful, I had to print it twice, and then I'll even read some of the commentary from it. It becomes us to inquire if, in the history of the world, any people have ever been thoroughly Christianized without the employment of their own agency to a large extent in diffusing the gospel amongst themselves. I know of no such people. So that right there is exactly what you said. He saw, he brought up the question, can we fully be able to do this? Can we fully Christianize our enslaved people just by us doing it? We have to get some of their own people to do it for us for this mission to be fully complete. And he says without that, he knows no such people who've ever done it. And so now what's interesting that follows is when you read some of his stuff, he sort of had issue. Let me just read. The point that I want to make on this evil genius is that back in 1831, during this infamous sermon, I'll get it out, he was against Negro preachers, end quote. We have colored ministers and exhorters, and while their ministrations are infrequent and conducted in great weakness, there are some of those whose moral character is justly suspected and who may be considered blind leaders of the blind. And I don't know if I mentioned it there, I mentioned somewhere else, they were deathly afraid of Nat Turner. I think you had mentioned him. But when folks got wind, Colcock too, when he got wind of what Nat Turner and other folks was doing, they was like, oh, hell no. And so at that point, he was really against Negro preachers because he had heard of, and I forget the time period, so that was 1831, 1832 maybe when he first did it, but there were other folks who weren't, other black folks who were preaching it, but weren't preaching it, you know, the way that he felt it was. So back then, he had an issue with us doing it. And so then I asked, what changed his mind? And it's like, who really knows? As late as 1842, he sort of held the same position when you look at the book, The Religious Destruction of the Negro, and then I even give you the pages, 210 to 215. But then this was interesting, so I had to put this in here. One possible hint at this upcoming change may possibly have been a statement from an unnamed, quote-unquote, venerable colored preacher who, in the strongest self-hating language imaginable, allegedly told Dr. Jones this. And so now this quote is coming from, like I said, Religious Destruction of the Negro was a sermon and a full book. And so what I'm about to quote is in the full book of Religious Destruction of the Negro, coming from what Colcock called a venerable colored preacher. He says, sir, it is the gospel that we, ignorant and wicked people, need. If you will give us the gospel, it will do more for the obedience of servants and the peace of community than all your guards and guns and bayonets. And it was one of those, I just had to stop. You know, I'm writing the book and doing stuff. When I came across that, I just had to stop and close it down and go walk, you know, because that had pissed me off. I'm like, what? Are you serious? Well, black guy, you saying, I mean, you know, it's no different from the Jesse Lee Petersons of today, but just putting that together, I was just, that quote just irked me, and I had to take a break and come back to it. But so that's my lead to that possibly may have been the reason why Colcock changed his initial position, because maybe hearing that statement and others that didn't get recorded from this so-called venerable colored preacher, he saw that, hey, we got to get more folks like this guy who, you know, may be the reincarnation of A. Long and Creflo Dollar and T.D.J., you know, who knows. But we need more people like them to give this instruction so that black folks can become Christians in a larger sense. And so, yeah.
Right. They still use that same exact language. Now, it's interesting, you talked about the time period. I think they said that he was born in 1804, right? Right. So, of course, that's the year that we declared, you know, our independence in Haiti and established the Republic, January 1st, 1804. 1831 is when Nat Turner had his, you know, armed resistance.
Mm.
So there were a lot of things going on as he was growing up. As, you know, in 1804,
right,
he's born, Haiti is free. They know, like, okay, slavery is not going to last too much longer because these niggas are going crazy. They're killing, you know, crackers. They're taking crackers' heads off. There are uprisings happening all over the southeastern United States. So they were scrambling. They had to move towards abolition, but then they wanted to continue enslavement. So they had to bring the new enslavement, which was the Christianity. And he just, you know, you just lay it out here. So now you also, you touch on, near the end, you touch on when somebody gives you the, you know, one of the age-old nonsense excuses. Well, white people were just using Christianity wrong. That's the only real problem. We're doing it the right way, and we can't focus on what you said in this book because they were just misusing it. So then you had a response for that in the book. So just talk about the response that you give to people who, you know, bring up that nonsensical argument. Of course, Jesus doesn't exist. None of the characters exist. But the way you laid it out in the book, how do you often approach people who try to discount the book and the information in the book and say, well, they were just misusing the quote-unquote religion?
That's when, if they're still listening to me, that's when I try to go into the history piece. Because 9 times out of 10, folks have no idea of the history behind that book. All the different so-called scrolls that were used and misused and deliberately lost, they have no understanding of the breakdown of Chinit, which then weakened it to a point to where the Christian stuff and the Coptic stuff comes in. They have no idea about Rome and Kemet and what was going on and how Kemet basically fell and became Egypt. That's how I phrase it. The history just of Rome during that particular time where we know about Constantine, but there were some other players in this too. And the empire was about to fall because you have this guy Arius, and I wish I could find out if he was an African or not, but he was one of the major proponents, what they call Gnostics, who was challenging, quote-unquote, Roman orthodoxy in how to do this thing that eventually became called Christianity. And like, when I first was getting into this whole religious piece, I learned about this quote-unquote Gnostics group early on. And in the new book that'll be coming out, I deliberately put all of the religion articles and stuff in chronological order so folks could even see my growth in the process. And so for a long time, I was just pumping up the Gnostics. I was like, at least read their stuff and get back to what they was doing. Because, like, one thing that really grabbed me about some of the quote-unquote Gnostics, because that's really a bad umbrella term because you had different groups doing sort of different things. But what was one good thing is you didn't have a dedicated preacher for some of these groups that are called Gnostics. What they would do is the heads, they would put all their names in a hat and shake them up, and someone would pull it, and whatever name would come up, that would be the person that would give the particular speech that day. So that helped sort of keep the ego down because everyone would have to be prepared because anyone could be the speaker at any particular given time. Depending upon some of the Gnostic teachings and who you talk to, quote-unquote Gnostic teachings, the way they looked at women was totally different from how Roman Christianity and Christianity of today went about it. Reading some of those documents in the Nag Hammadi library before folks reinterpret them and put a whole bunch of BS in. When I first read some of those documents from the actual book of that title, Nag Hammadi Library, as well as Elaine Pagel's, why am I blanking on this book? I'm blanking on her book, but it was like her first or second book. Just blew me away. And she got grief over that book, and she never wrote as strongly or as poignantly from every other book from the, and I'm mad that I won't get the title because that book was
talking about
when I remember it.
The Gnostic Gospels.
Thank you. Yes, that one. That book blew me away because she was going through some of the stuff and how some of the scrolls, you know, was Jesus is talking about, I am the only God here, I'm the big dad, whatever, whatnot, and you hear a big booming female voice basically telling Jesus, the character Jesus, you're being arrogant, stop it. You know that there are people who have been around before you doing this sort of stuff. And, you know, that book was, of course, totally thrown out of the Bible. And so, yeah, the Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels and the Non-Comedy Library, where you actually, the older version, not the newer version, where you actually read some of these documents that didn't get included into the quote-unquote King James Orthodox version, just totally, totally floored me. And so there we go. It's right there. I should have just looked at my book. So, yeah, so that's how I would read. That's how I respond, and that's how I laid it here. It's like you got that history, or to just the answer properly addressed would fill at least three books. I would first tell the inquirer to read Shadow of the Third Century by Alvin Boyd Kuhn to get an accurate understanding of how what we now call Christianity really was started. And so again, I have to do a caveat. The only complaint that I have against that magnificent 600-page book is that he makes a divide between Christianity and Christendom. And I think he liked Christendom but didn't like Christianity, and so I forget that distinction. But outside of that distinction, he goes through and slaughters Christianity and rips them a new one. He's talking about, you know, if Jesus was to come back, he wouldn't know what the heck y'all was talking about because he himself wasn't a Christian. He never called it Christianity. He goes in through talking about the Gnostics. I read that entire book, like I said, 600 pages, a long time ago, and I really liked it. And the way if folks can get through, you know, 600 pages of that book and move beyond his try to bifurcate a Christianity versus Christendom, if they can excuse him for that but then read his scathing critique of it, I think they'd be well on their way. And as a side note, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, a white boy, was a student, if you will, of Gerald Massey. One of the very few white boys, with all his imperfections, with his push on evolution and with his, you know, he sort of uses a few bad terms dealing with us in his books, but he is one of those Caucasoids I give credit to. And, you know, Dr. Clark, Dr. Ben, and John G. Jackson loved him as well. But so Alvin Boyd Kuhn is coming from the Massey school. So if you're familiar with Massey's work, the in-depth, the how dense particular lines are, and sort of, you know, verbose, Alvin Boyd Kuhn is sort of like that as well, but it's a refreshing read if you like hearing people diss on Christianity from a historical, you know, perspective. I continue, I would recommend The Council of Nicaea, 325, by Dean Dudley, to better understand the voting and decision-making tactics that made Christianity what it is today. The Bible did not fall the hell out of the sky, that Moses crap is a myth. They had from 30 upwards to 40 councils and conferences to decide on the Trinity, to decide on Jesus' quote-unquote birthday and resurrection, all that sort of stuff. All these conferences to decide on, and they still sort of didn't get an answer to if he is the Son of God or if he is God, period. As we know, that divided the whole Christian schools, you know, the monophysites and the disophysites, if I'm pronouncing it right. But that whole thing, these were conferences and councils that they voted and decided on. And especially with 325, you've got to read the document, you've got to read that particular book because it goes through what happened. Every single person who came to the conference who was a dissenting voice, you read, folks got their eyes plugged out. You read, folks got their ears cut off. Arius, the main guy who, for one reason or another, the whole conference of Nicaea 325 had to be convened, in 332, he mysteriously died. He just died. It was like, we need your ass off the scene. So he just died. But reading other folks who didn't fully were, you know, were murdered, they losing eyes and losing limbs and losing ears and stuff. So these Romans weren't playing. You coming with descent, they gave the impression that we want to hear your descent in a logical format and we will listen to every, you know, all that sort of stuff. But then when you read what happened to those dissenters, it's like they just want to get y'all all in a room to whoop y'all ass and either kill y'all or maim y'all or basically shut y'all up. And so that's why I list that book, because it walks through how what happens when you dissent against what Constantine and other folks want to do to push the agenda of creating Christianity. I would also share Who Wrote the Bible by Richard Friedman and The Unholy Double Cross by Jafar A. Bashir for an accurate depiction of how the book folks call the Bible really came into being. Again, the Septuagint and the Wynedale and all these different versions of the Bible and the process. Like, I wrote this book before I came across another book by Adam Nicholson called God's Secretary. And they got pictures in there of all these folks. Nobody black, so it's all these white folks who were doing these different translations. And he walks through how the translation process was working and how it went from, you know, from different languages and some of the backgrounds of the people who was translating and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, when you read all this stuff, you're like, this is the holy book, the word of God, the unalterable, untempered, pure word of God. You can only say that if you have no idea about the history of it. And so I lay that out, and then I end Elaine Pagel's excellent work, Gnostic Gospel, intimates how certain books were left out of the now authorized canon of a holy writ. She lays out how sexism is fundamental within biblical constructs, as well as addressing Christianity's real origins and why the present form most people practice had to win out over its predecessor, loosely and wrongly called the Gnosticism. And so yeah, that, and then I could keep on going, but that would be, you know, if folks would listen, because, you know, they just think you're promoting devil worship and all that sort of stuff. So if they listen, I try to give a quick history, and if they really seem like they want to hear it, then I'll go further and give them some books to read, because almost 98-99% of black folks who be up in the churches every Sunday have no idea about the real tangible history. The real tangible history. I even remember, and I'll shut up because I see the time is getting lesser. I can remember, I even, because I'm a religious studies major, or I was, or I'm going to get back to it. And so I had to take class on Christianity. And there was about, you know, at the beginning of the class, you know, there was maybe about 7 or 8 black folks in there. And, you know, black folks was thinking, okay, we about to learn about preaching and the sermons, all that sort of stuff. I don't know what they was thinking. But after that first day when he was laying out, you know, the syllabus and we're going to go through the history, and I think, no, not even, maybe the first day, maybe the second day, when the teacher actually said, we don't know which words Jesus actually spoke. And then they're going through, you know, the different forms and this Q form, which may be the document that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John pulled from, and the earliest, you know, documented documents of the gospel comes, you know, some 70 years or 80 years after the quote-unquote Jesus actually existed. By the third class, there was only me and one other black person left, because I guess, I don't know what those black folks was thinking when they was taking the class, but they didn't want to hear all of this history, and they didn't want to hear the teacher, you know, just come out and say stuff that for folks who study it, it's just commonplace. But for folks who just blindly follow it and, you know, practice it or whatnot, they had no idea. And so they didn't want to take the class, and they dropped it. And so by the end, it was just me and one other person. And even with my scathing critique, my final report on the class was called Ife Okono, How Christianity Basically, You Know, Ripped Up Angola. He gave me an A, and again, that the whole piece will be in the new book, so folks can check it out. He gave me an A because it was well-oriented, but, you know, in parentheses, he was like, it would have been nice if you could have laid out some of the positive aspects of Christianity in Africa. I wanted to tell him, come on, it's not. But, you know, I just shut up and got the A and kept it moving.
Right, you know the crack was going to try to something in. But that's one thing about the opposition research. Just like, you know, in political speak today, when people are talking about politicians and Democrats and Republicans and all that nonsense, you can often, you know, get some accurate information on the other side when they're doing opposition research against each other. So very often the people who are atheists or Gnostics or whatever, the ones who are opposing or appear to be opposing the conventional Christianity, the opposition research will pull up some, you know, some basic things, even though all of them are lying because they're all white supremacists. You know what I'm saying? They're just trying to give you a different version of it. But there will be, you know, some things that pop up, incidental information that incidentally shine the light on something accurate that you can investigate. But one thing that I noticed that some of our people have, like in the 90s when black bookstores really started blowing up, early 90s, you had like in the Chicago area, you had like 23 black bookstores in and around the Chicago area. It became very popular because of hip-hop, conscious hip-hop. People started listening. People started going to black bookstores. A lot of books were being written. But it was a couple of things that started being, a lot of books were released. All of the New World Order kind of books, they were filling up black bookstores. They weren't filling up white bookstores. They were filling up black bookstores. A lot of conspiratorial books, every now and then you have something that's just basically accurate, the crackers are in control, but then you had a lot of other stuff talking about aliens and, you know, they're trying to take us away from Christianity, so getting back to the real Christianity is the true origin and all that. So all the New World Order type information were filling up black bookstores. On the cultural and spiritual side, you had people, you know, putting some information out. The only book that I knew about at that point that went in hard proving that Jesus never existed was Walter Williams' Historical Origin of Christianity,
right,
when he released that. But there was a lot of people putting Massey's works out, like Ancient Egyptian, Egypt, Light of the World, and the Book of the Beginnings and stuff like that. Now, the problem is people didn't know how to sift through the information. And because some of our scholars, you know, They supported it, or like Dr. Finch would, you know, wrote forewords to it. Then the next phase was people took it wholesale, and the next thing you know, you have a whole crop of people for the next 10, 15 years talking about there was a historical Jesus, and then but the fictional, mythical Jesus was the one, you know, the sun god, the savior god you find all over the ancient world, but the historical Jesus was Yeshua ben Pandera, or Jesus Ben Pandera, which they got from Gerald Massey. So you got people, of course, and he didn't exist either. Gerald Massey got that wrong, but then Charles Finch co-signed it, and then other people co-signed it, and next thing you know, you have a whole decade of people plus talking about, well, there was a historical Jesus, and he lived at this particular, you know what I'm saying? So we didn't know how to filter that information, but it always goes back to you have to deal with the actual sources, which is why we went directly to ancient Kemet and found the deity. You know, Jesus, Neferetep, Heru is where they get Jesus or Yeshua from, showing that Moses and Aaron and Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and all these characters didn't exist black or white. So that's been an issue. Hold on one second. We just want to let people know you have 2 minutes if you want to listen to the show beyond 11 o'clock live. Without, you have a minute and a half to call, to get on the phone, get on, in the call queue, 657-383-0635 if you want to listen for overtime. We won't go too long on overtime, but you got like a minute left if you want to stay on 657-383-0635. Okay. So, yeah, I just want to bring that out that we have to, and like we talked about earlier, when people say, start talking about things that they've learned about Christianity or metaphysics or Kabbalism and all this other stuff, and then you ask them honestly, did you investigate that? or did you just embrace what somebody said? And if they're honest, they'll tell the truth. Well, no, I didn't investigate. They're just repeating whatever scholar that they feel good about or they like, or they have some sentimental attachment to, they just repeat it. And in these instances, with regard to Massey and a couple of the other ones, some people will just take it wholesale and they will not sift through that information and see what he stole directly from Comet and where he colored the information to his own, you know, for his own desire, you know. And so we want to put that in there.
And see, to even jump on that, even on a, from a different angle, you are exactly correct. But now, let's say we don't even get that deep. What I have found with folks is that Massey has some direct quotes in there that would let folks know he's not trying to push Christianity. He is saying we need to leave it alone. And they will just, especially in H.E.'s of Light of the World, they will just jump to that appendix where he does his back and forth piece. And it's just like, did y'all even read anything? Because like the quote-unquote easiest book of his to read is his lectures. And I wish I was thinking ahead and I would have pulled out the exact quote. But someone asked him, do you think the Bible, you know, should be taught in regular schools and whatnot? Bible instruction should be taught. And he was like, absolutely not. And he was like, the Bible doesn't move you from basically a second childhood. It's okay for stories and fables, you know, if you want to tell them to children, but it keeps you in like a second childhood, you know, if an adult follows Christianity. And it's like every other line within the book, he's, you know, saying, no, this isn't the Christian piece isn't the origin of it. It's a bastardization of something from Kemet. And, you know, you're more an expert in seeing what he got right and what he got wrong in that piece. But when folks just blindly use Massey as the reference point of, hey, Christianity is a black thing, I just want to look at them and be like, you didn't read anything on the inside of the book, did you? And so that upsets me. But then also upsets me, since you brought up Charles Finch, on good authority told me that he said, Finch is quoted as saying that after he had finished reading Gerald Massey's work, he became a better Catholic. And again, I have read large chunks of all his stuff, Books to Beginning, Natural Genesis, H.E. of Light of the World, lectures. I didn't went to Library of Congress. There's, you know, there's like one piece that ain't been published by nobody that I dug up. I know about him and his wife, and one piece, you know, I'll come back to that. But so all of this, and I done read all of this, and I'm just like, you, this scholar guy, you are saying that you became a bad... You must have misread something, because every other line he is dissing Christianity. He's saying it's stupid and ignorant to think that this is, you know, actual historical and it's, you know, representation and zoological and all this other stuff. He's every other line. And so Finch, you know, he's done otherwise good work. But on that piece where he supposedly is giving him an analysis of Gerald Massey, he missed a boat somewhere. And other folks have jumped on that Titanic-esque boat, and they're sinking down with him. And I've always said that at some point I wanted to do like a counter or a different version of an understanding of Gerald Massey from a African-centered perspective. I just haven't gotten around to it yet, but that has always hurt me. But one other the other quick note about Massey that I liked is that right around the time when he was finishing up Ancient Egypt, Light of the World, the two volumes, his wife, right around that beginning 1900s time, there was a group of Caucasoids who were getting into what they called spiritism or spiritualism, where they were attempting to deal with spirits. Now, of course, from your great work, they was only dealing with spirits of disorder. We get that. But even at that time, that was a radical concept for white folks. because, you know, they've been doing witch burnings and all that sort of stuff, you know, their whole culture and moving towards a scientific understanding of reality and leaving the magical aspects and all that sort of stuff alone. And so Massey, his wife got him into attempting to look at more of the spirit version, I guess, of the world at that time, and she was into it, and she got him into it for a while, and so I just thought that that was very interesting that, you know, he had always been, but especially during that time, because the Ancient Egypt Light of the World is probably his most clearest work, you know, how Dr. Clark, well, no, he actually said in the beginning, he wrote Book of the Beginning in the, you know, the fog of day, natural genesis at noon, but he wrote this one at the, you know, at the twilight, you know, with meaning he wrote it more clear with clarity and stuff like that. And so while, you know, again, he's a Caucasoid and he's coming from a particular perspective, you can never rule that out. I just really found that sort of interesting that he was really, you know, because I don't want to make this all about Gerald Massey, but he was part of a clique. Him, Church Ward, Hilton Hodema, and one other person, the Anacalypsis guy. They were all buddies. And Massey, and at the time, these you know, white metaphysicians and whatnot, they were all trying to lean towards Asia as the beginning of humanity and stuff like that. And out of that clique, Massey was the only one that said, no, it's Africa. And it only makes sense for it to be in Africa. And so even amongst his peers at that time, he was sort of, you know, the white sheep of his peer group. And so he even went more white sheep when him and his wife decided to, you know, try to engage in spirit and spirit communication, you know, however tenuous that is, because, again, they were only dealing with spiritual disorder. But I just really, really, on the levels that we can, like Massey and some of the way that he was pushing stuff, and it just irks me to no end when folks just fully misread him and try to say stuff that he wasn't saying because they ain't read the damn books. I mean, you know, 500, 600 pages each volume, most folks ain't going to read all that. But if you do, if you just read a little bit of it, you cannot look at Christianity the same way. You just can't do it.
Well, all they will do is they can find, like Finch found, he mentioned there was a historical Jesus. That's all they need to hear. As soon as they hear that, they go, you know, zoom in on that part and run with it, and then they're going to make the historical Jesus black. And there you go. They got it. So, like, for example, in his Kamite Genesis of Christianity, the article, the essay he put at the end of his African Origin of Medical Science, Dr. Finch's book. Now, for a while, before Walter Williams put his book out, that was one of the few black scholars who addressed, you know, African origins of, you know, Christianity, quote unquote. And of course, black people did not create Christianity. That's a lie.
Right.
But he just basically copied everything that Gerald Massey said about, you know, the etymologies of the names Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and Yahweh and Jesus and Moses and all of them. Now, all of the etymologies that Massey put forward and Dr. Finch, you know, put out there were totally inaccurate, 100%. The one for Abraham, totally inaccurate. Yahweh, Isaac, Ishmael, Jesus, every etymology for the origin of the name was totally inaccurate. And he just repeated all of that. People got excited about it. Of course, again, they didn't investigate. They just, because Dr. Finch said it, they ran with it. They said they liked Gerald Massey. Even though he was a cracker, they picked him up. Some of our other scholars did, so they just jumped on and said, well, he must be all right. And then on top of that, saying, hey, there's a historical Jesus, so that just made their day. You know what I'm saying? That just pushed them into, you know, deeper into Christianity. That's why, you know, Charles Finch could say he's a better Christian after reading that nonsense, because now he can embrace it. Actual individual thinking that he existed Yeshua ben Pandera, which is a fictional character, and then he can try to say, well, it all came from our people anyway, and we created original Christianity, so you have people talking that nonsense. But you mentioned, like, Godfrey Higgins, Anacalypsis, that's another two-volume set that a lot of people started studying. A lot of the Moors read that because it, you know, talks about ancient America and things like that, and they, of course, misread that whole thing. That's when you read the opposition research coming from the Achiwadipo, where one white person like Massey or Higgins or somebody else appears to be attacking other white orthodoxy, and you don't realize that they're both the whites and their offspring, they're still spirits of disorder, you can't embrace either one. But while one is attacking the other one, they're still producing nonsense. So while in Anacalypsis, he talks about, you know, black people establishing civilizations around the world in ancient times, he wasn't promoting, you know, our culture and our people. So these people, of course, they'll latch on to a few things. They'll even latch on with Gerald Massey dealing with, you know, the whole spiritism movement, which was just they were trying to bring the occult out and make it more popular, bring it out of the shadows and make it as popular as Christianity. Just like they, you know, Masonic individuals were getting parades, like the parades in Chicago, the parade, you know, the political parades, and they'll walk down the street and they have their little fezes on and they'll just say they're fraternal organizations and just try to make themselves normal. They were trying to, that was an outgrowth of what the spiritism movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s was getting at. They were trying to bring the so-called occult into popular culture. So some of them would start doing seances and all this other stuff. So that has forced some of our people who are going along with traditional Christianity, conventional Christianity, but they latch on to something like Gerald Massey or churchward to these other people. Now they get pushed into the occult nonsense or the pseudo-esoteric nonsense, and they've been running with that. And so you'll have disciples of churchward and Massey and other people, and they can do no wrong because they were like, well, they were into the spiritual sciences of our people, which, of course, they were not, so they don't have access to that. They don't know nothing about it. So what they were teaching was misinformation, but some of our people get holed up into that nonsense, while other people, the majority, get holed up into, you know, conventional Christianity. So if we don't go back to the source, and it goes back to what we were talking about last night, Maranechi, divine law and divine hate. If you don't embrace your natural repulsion for all of the whites and their offspring, then you'll start accepting things that normally you just wouldn't accept. If you automatically reject them and anything that comes from them, then you can sift through certain things because you're never going to accept anything that they have. You're always going to be repulsed by them. But you will never nothing will ever slip by you because you're just like that magnet on the table pushing the other one across. It will never naturally connect with the other magnet. So nothing they put forward or project, we will always repel them. So we can pick through some things that they're lying about through that opposition research, but we won't make that the foundation of what we're doing because we know no matter what they write, no matter what they publish, it's always going to be the foundational principle that their spirits of disorder and what they emanate is going to be disorder. So, in fact, that's one of the reasons we put the Cuckoo Tum Tum out, because outside of Walter Williams, we saw a lot of people going down the road of, like, a Dr. Finch or, you know, other people who were, you know, basically it was a new form of let's put Christianity back on the map. We're just going to blacken it up and just say it all came from ancient Kemet.
Albert Klee, Ishmael Bereshango, yeah.
Right. And the result of that is now you have a number of people who are walking around talking about ancient Kemetic Christianity and, you know, Jesus was a priest in ancient Kemet and all kinds of nonsense. You know what I'm saying? All kinds of foolishness.
If I hear one more person say the African origins of Christianity, I will literally throw up.
Right. And if you press them on it, it usually goes back to one of the first things they'll point to is Charles Finch and his support of Gerald Massey's work. It'll go back to that because that's the first time they read it from a black person in some detail. You know, so we gotta fight through that, but that's what we have to expose on every level. None of the characters existed. And then we're going to get into some of that next week as well. But, yeah, so now we have... Go ahead.
There was a few things I left out with Cold Cock that I finally just found. If I could quickly, I know you're about to shut down, quickly get them in the record.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Or you got to go. Okay. I just wanted to give a little bit more detail for folks who will be listening and stuff, just to let you know the mental footwork that Cold Cock put in on this. And so he walked through the when, the best times to give religious destruction to the Negroes. He says, and this is a quote, "Town, city, and village ministers, the best time of day for service should be between the afternoon and evening. For country ministers, afternoons would be best. Everyone should stay away from nighttime services because late meetings are commonly hurried and subject to more or less disorder." So he had sat down. He then broke it down to, based on your location and where you are as far as an enslaved African owner, here's the best times that you should give your religious instruction. He also laid out, and I think we mentioned the benefits as far as the greater subordination, the best servants to those who profess religion. But then he also gives the why. Here is why. If you do this, this is what will happen. And I quote, "Let them," the slave masters, "invest a little capital in the minds and hearts of their people," that's us Africans, "and it will prove to all concerned a peace-giving and profitable investment for time and for eternity." So he's telling you, if you just invest some time and a little bit of capital in the hearts and minds of your property with this Christian peace, it will be a peace-giving and profitable investment for time and for eternity. And if those right there are not prophetic words when we look at 2014 Gregorian calendar and 13,014 on our calendar, if I'm right, from your calculations, those words are so prophetic. Because right now, we're still marching through the drum beat. I still think we're in the 70s, maybe even 80th percentile of the Christian peace, again, based off of the work that Cold Cock has done. I just wanted to get those other pieces in. If anybody had doubts on how deep he was thinking in with this, I wanted to just get rid of any of those doubts. And then lastly, I don't want to leave out how folks can reconnect. And I had listed a few books for folks if they want to. Okay, so I say, so you've made it this far. That's an accomplishment based on the job the Caucasoids have done, are doing with our traditions. That could mean you're an African from the lights of the light to the darkest of the dark, who has heard the call, felt the nudge of your African ancestors, and just never knew how to respond. You have attempted to blacken up or even indinkraize your religious colonizer's material, of course to no avail. Or maybe you correctly jettisoned the religiously bankrupt systems in all of its forms, only to find yourself in the nebulous, nondescript spiritual category, or worse, in a spiritual void. And so then what I do is I give a few books for folks to read to help reorient themselves to an African understanding of spiritness, spirituality. And so I give Ancestors, Hidden Hands, Healing Spirits by Baba Lyle Ra. Ifabeme, of course, and you know I still must be, still my favorite piece of your work is Ubin Shang, Ancestral Summons. Also list Cuckoo to a Tomb, The Ancestral Jurisdiction, Let the Circle Be Unbroken by Marimba Ani, and The Healing Wisdom of Africa by Maladoma Somme as just some books to begin to reconceptualize spirituality. And I mean, Amos talks about it as well as far as, and Mama Rimba Ani, the way we have even been taught to approach the divine, all of it comes from Caucasoid. How to deal with it, how to address it, how to approach it, it's all come from them. So if we don't do this right, we have to reorient ourselves. And that's why Ubin Shang, when I read it years and years ago when you gave it to me, it just floored me because I had never read, as I call it, how do I call it, an African-centered, philosophically applicable work, because it's just breaks stuff down. One-page breakdowns, but each page is so densely rich with African cosmology and African ontology that there's still, outside of your own work, there's still nothing else on the market that is that rich with African cosmology and African ontology. And so that re-changing how we even address spirit and spirits and spiritness, you got to go through that process to be able to then come back home spiritually. One of the quotes I came up with, we will never truly be free until we return to our African spirituality. But to do that, you can't just do it still with a Christian mindset. And that's another reason why I really love your works, because you call on the carpet all these Ifa or Akan folks who are trying to Christianize our stuff. African spirituality for me is one of the key ways out of this confusion and craziness. And we can't have people on the inside of it trying to bring the stupidity into that one key that will get us out of this stupidness. So you coming hardcore with it, help me come hardcore with it. Because I remember one time I was like, I don't know, have you heard of anybody else? I think I was, you know, trying to figure out. I think I asked you, can you be African-centered and not deal with African spirituality? And even way back then, you was like, no, you can't do it. And you were the first person that I had heard come hard with it. And then after you open the door, then, you know, you get quotes from Baba Carruthers, Jedi Shimsu Jehudi. That was basically like, we got to leave it and throw it away. And after you had opened that door, then other folks started coming saying, no, we can't do it. We got to come home. And then Mama Marimba, you know, in Yorugu, she just blasted all the way. And so I just, you know, had to give folks something as far as different type of solutions, different areas to look at to do something different spiritually, because what we're doing ain't working. And then, of course, I had to talk about white folks who are running certain spiritual houses. I basically said, you got to leave them. We cannot allow Caucasoids to be the gatekeepers to spiritual traditions that are ours by birthright. We cannot allow Caucasoids to be the spiritual key holders to unlock the power of our African traditions that they have fought and still fight us so intensely over. We cannot allow Caucasoids to believe that they are giving us God again, especially not from inside of our own systems. And then I concluded, you know, with some nice conclusionary words and all that sort of stuff. That's basically how to make a Negro Christian, lulu.com/Kamau301, $17. Pick it up. Once folks do get it and read it, and they love it. There's been at least 8 or 9 folks that have hit me up in different venues saying how much they really appreciate the book. A few folks had even called in on the show, either called in on my show or they were talking about it on their show, talking about how eye-opening and stuff it was. So, again, you got to get this so you can get the actual documents and read it for yourself, because it is not a divine spark. It is not something that the God of gods wanted us to do as far as Christianity. If you don't talk about there's a kernel of truth in everything, you can deal with a kernel, or you can come all the way back home with the fully popcorn, if you want to use that analogy. We don't have to deal with the kernel of truth that may or may not, and I would say, hey, in those books, it's time for us to come home. And so that's the overlying emphasis of why I wrote How to Make a Negro Christian, with the hope that folks that get the actual document, they will see, like, we've been bamboozled, hoodwinked, and led astray. And then they are also given a few resources on how to come back home spiritually.
Yes, now there's one at the end when you're at the conclusion. Now, you published the book in 06. And two of the books that you have referenced, there's a couple of developments that happened since 06. Now, I remember, let me see, about probably like 14 years ago, I got that brother's book, Ancestors, Hidden Hands, Healing Spirits, Minister Ra, Ifak Bemi, Babalao. And that's one of the ones you list. And he was just talking about establishing an ancestor shrine and why it's important for us to have an ancestor shrine. You know, the basic things, most people don't know anything about that. He was involved in the Yoruba tradition, so most people never heard of anything like that. He just gave a very simple, basic approach. I think it's like a 40-page book, a small book. Just a basic thing that people who are involved in traditions know about, but the average person has never heard about, right? What happened, what developed years later, which I found out, and you can see online.
Are you about to bust my bubble?
This Negro, now, a few years back, I saw him on some videos. He no longer calls himself Minister Ra Ifak Bemi Babalao. Now he's an openly gay, so-called traditional priest, and he's wearing Kemet clothes, and he shaved his head, and he's sitting there talking about all the Dogon priests with faggots and all this other nonsense. And he's put himself out there saying, I'm openly gay, and all this other nonsense. So, so apparently he was a homo when he wrote the book, but, you know, you know what I'm saying? So, but the thing is, in the book, he doesn't have anything in there that's like anything that he came up with. He just gave him basic things like people set up shrines, they put candles, they burn incense, they say prayers, and just anything that if you back then, 14 years ago, there weren't all these websites out talking about Yoruba tradition, Akan, and all this other stuff. So the only way you could get some information is if somebody wrote a book or if you were on some Orishalist forum or something like that. So it was a big deal for somebody to actually publish information about shrine work in a book. But now, you can get that anywhere, you know what I'm saying? So his little book, it don't matter. You know what I'm saying? You can find that in, you know, all over the internet now, basic setup for shrines. People have their e-lays, their own websites for e-lays or boats on fiers, whatever, so you can get that information from anywhere. He came out as a flaming faggot ass nigger, you know what I'm saying, all online. So I will replace that.
Please send that to me.
Yeah, it's on. I have to find it, but he's on YouTube, though. He's on YouTube, and he's trying to, you know, he's pushing some nonsense. So I will replace that with, for example, one of Nganga or Dr. Fukiao's books, Self-Healing Power and Therapy, where he talks about the Bakongo tradition, and he goes into detail about cosmology and everything and ancestral communication and all that kind of stuff. It's a small book, but it's very powerful. And it's precise, you know what I mean? So I would replace that one with that one because he still goes into, you know, he even goes into it in more detail, as a matter of fact. So that one. Then, of course, Maladoma Somme, since he published that Healing Wisdom of Africa over 10 years ago, when he first came out, he was just, oh, this is a brother from the continent, and he's trying to navigate the balance between traditional life and the contemporary modern technical world. And that's all people thought he was. He was a modern-day shaman, as they would call him. So people were like, oh, he wrote a book about his, you know, things. But then, years later, well, you already know, this Negro came out and started talking about, you know, homosexuals are gatekeepers and they're spiritual and they have a role in the cosmology of the culture and all this other nonsense and lying on the god of culture and then his wife's lying on it and everything else. He's being supported by white homosexual male groups and they're bringing him out and he's initiating them and they're playing traditional drums and dressing in traditional clothes and all this faggot homo shit that he's doing, right? So, even with his, I would replace Dr. Fukuya also has African cosmology of the Bantu Congo. So, so the whole thing about the Dikenga and the, you know, four positions of the sun and all
that. That was a bit deep for the layman people. That was a bit deep for it. See, I like the other one you replaced it with because it's not simple because his works aren't simple, you know, Fukuya. But, you know, that one is a bit more graspable. But that African Cosmology Bantu Tango, that's a deep book. And see, those five that I was listing was, you know, for folks who were just coming into it. They had just got through the beginning part. So you got another maybe easier, simple one to replace it with maybe?
Okay. Yeah, definitely Self-Healing Power and Therapy by Dr. Fukuya. let me see. Something simple. And I know what you mean as far as African cosmology, Bantu Congo, it's, you know, it's technical. It's not just like an introductory book. If you're not already somewhat familiar with something, you're going to have to be really attentive, you know what I'm saying? Actually, you know what? The very first volume of a book called After God is Dibia, D-I-B-I-A, by Ume, U-M-E-H. His name is John Anene Chukwu Ume, but his last name is Ume, but it's on Igbo cosmology. It's a two-volume set, After God is Dibia. First volume is shorter than the second volume, is more detailed with a lot more information. But he talks about Igbo cosmology. He talks about the Dibia, which is the high priest, male or female, in Igbo tradition, which is the same on the same level as Baba Lao in the Yoruba tradition. But he goes into the cosmology, talking about the Igbo divinities, talking about the creation story of the Igbo and how Afa came into the world, the divination system.
Right.
And actually, people don't know that, you know, Yoruba got Ifa from the Igbo. So when they talk about it, it came from, you know, they got it directly from Oromila and all that. They got it from the Igbo. So, there's some political stuff going on between them, so they have to change the stories around.
Yeah.
But
you are always starting
they
stuff.
Talk about, well, you know, in fact, the Igbo would talk about not Oromila brought Ifa to the Yoruba people in Ile Ife. They talk about Afa came about through the Igbo woman. So that's the origin of Afa. So because of what happened with the Igbo woman, and she's somebody, she could see the past, present, and future, and she was reading people, and when she made her transition, they sent a delegation to Chukwu, which is the great father in heaven, Komosu is the great mother, asking what they could do, and then he gave them a means by which they could still communicate past, present, and future, and that's how Afa came into the world and all that. So it has to do with the female. And even in Rodon, when they talk about Fa, they talk about Badu and her opening her eyes, and that's Fa and all that. So it's another female divinity. So it's just the Yoruba. The Yoruba is an anomaly with regard to Ifa, Fa, Afa. They have their own thing, but the Yoruba know they got it from the Igbo. It's kind of known. But yeah, I would say After God is Dibia, that Igbo cosmology book. You can replace that one with Maladoma Somme's book, because he's going around the country promoting dissexuality, and that's why he gets all that funding from those white male homosexual dissexual groups. That's how he's making his money. So, and
I knew about
that, a lot of Negroes talking about, you know. You said what now?
Now, I was going to say, yeah, I knew about him, unfortunately, but I didn't know about Ifa Bema. So that's just blowing me right there.
Yeah, and he changed his name, so it's a different name. But he's like another, really like another Malachi Europe, you know what I'm saying? But openly professing his faggotry and proud of it, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah. But the good thing,
thank you for those corrections.
Oh yeah, because I remember, you know, I just happened to come on some video. I was looking for something else, and it was somebody, you know, sitting there, and it had a title talking about ancient Kemet. I was like, damn, he looked kind of familiar. And I was like, wait a minute, that's the guy who wrote the book. That's the guy who wrote the book we used to sell, like back in the day when I was working at the bookstore. We used to recommend the book to people. You know what I'm saying? Because it was short, it was concise, it was simple, and it was just talking about basic things about ancestral shrine. So we used to recommend it. And yeah. You know, I see this guy, you know what I'm saying? The same one, and he's almost. So, you know.
Wow.
But, you know, that's the fight. We got to, you know, crackers are, you know, up in the ante with that, of course. So we have to exterminate that nonsense. And they're not going to stop what they're doing, so we have to stop.
Agreed.
Yep. But may I say for sharing all the information you're sharing with the African World Analysis, let me get the website again. AfricanWorldAnalysis.com. Africa is spelled with a K. So it's AfricanWorldAnalysis.com. And it's Kamal's publishing the periodical. There are 34 issues out. He's been publishing it since over a decade now. You can order all of the back issues, and he has a new issue coming out soon. Also, he hosts the show Africa's Reascension on Akwesi.com Sunday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Of course, he has the book, How to Make a Negro Christian, which we were just talking about, lulu.com, lulu.com/Kamau, K-A-M-A-U, number 301. So order that book, $16.95. And, you know, we're going to keep this information going, keep disseminating the information. May I say for coming on the show, you know, you can come back whenever you want to, and we just, you know, we appreciate the information.
Gracias for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, so we can, you know, we can do this again, especially when you, when do you think you're going to have the new the book out? You thinking by the end of summer, the fall, or something like that?
Closer to the winter, because there's stuff coming up for me in August that I have to give full attention to. But after that, I want to say around September-ish, that's when I can really start jumping into it. Because it's done. I just have to, you know, make it look all pretty and nice and stuff. I already got the ISBNs and everything, so it's just on getting it formatted to look good and getting it out there. So sometime more towards the end of the year.
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, just let us know. Definitely have you back on that piece. And may I say again, and just for another, making an announcement, we're on every Benada, every Tuesday, Abenada, 9 p.m. Eastern for our show Ojira, dealing with Afro-Akani ancestral religion and culture. And in every Awukuda or Akuada Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Egua Marketplace, which is today. Our guest for next week will be Brother Coach Lakoben Sankofa, or Bilal Sankofa. And we will be sending out an invitation and information about that. Again, we will be in Camp Springs, Maryland, this Akwesi Da Sunday, June 22nd, 12 p.m. We will be presenting on Nana Som, Afurakani, Afurakani, Ancestral Religion in America, and based on our restoration of our ancestral traditions, based on our blood circle, based on our direct blood ancestresses and ancestors that have come with us into the world. We'll be dealing with that. We will be selling our books. If you want to purchase our soft cover publications, go to our website, odwirafo.com, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in free, O.com. You can purchase the soft cover versions. You can download the ebook versions for free. And just contact us if you have any questions about the upcoming presentations in Maryland and 2 weeks later on July 5th in Hartford, Connecticut, and the upcoming other presentations that will be coming in the summer. We will be traveling to a number of different cities. If you want us to come out to your city, just give us a call or send us an email. Contact information is on the website, again, O-D-W-I-R-A-F, as in free, O.com. Hit us up, and we can, you know, give you all the information. Yerase, we thank you for tuning in, and we will connect with you next week. That's it.